Hello, motion picture brains. That's you, fans of light, darkness, composition, celluloid, zeros, and ones. Welcome back to another episode of the Through the Lens podcast. The unedited audio of our full conversation with the cinematographer. In this episode, we spoke with Peter Deming. Just to give you an idea of who Peter Deming is, he is known for, amongst other things, shooting Mulholland Drive, Cabin in the Woods, Drag Me to Hell, Lost Highway, Oz the Great and Powerful, Hollywood Shuffle, Evil Dead 2, My Cousin Vinny, I Heart Huckabees, House Party, Scream 2 and 3. He shot like a ton. He shot a ton of stuff. And he's like really, really interesting guy. And his stuff always looks fantastic. And I just can't say enough, like, you know, shot with David Lynch no less than three times. He's done everything from, just look at the list I just said. Hollywood Shuffle, it's like a movie that was made on credit cards for $100,000. Oz the Great and Powerful, $200 million, okay? That's a range. We met up with him at Handheld Films in New York City in October of 2012. Yes, Handheld Films, you rock. Now, we got something special for you this one, because this is the unedited podcast. This is the full conversation. We spoke for him for like 2.5 hours. But for a number of reasons, we are actually splitting up the episode as being the last episode. We're going to leave this visually as the last visual episode for the video version for season one. And then the first episode of season two is going to be the rest of this interview. Now, we're partially doing this because it's fun to leave you on a cliffhanger. But we're also partially doing it because maybe we lost just one of the three cameras of that interview's footage. Awesome! Awesome! Isn't that awesome? Somebody's a little bit embarrassed in the corner right now, but don't worry about it. It's fine. We're gonna have me in front of a brick wall sort of re-asking the same questions. Anyway. If you want to check out the first half of the video version of this interview, the Hollywood video version, you will find it at crafttrek.com as season 1 episode 20 of the Through the Lens, or you can go to youtube.com/crafttrek, and you can also subscribe if you're feeling shivery. It should also be noted that during this interview, Peter Deming pulled out a knife and sliced his eye wide open.
This is Peter Deming sharing his coffee.
Hold on.
I'm drinking. This is like the equivalent of David Lynch with his lunch, right? You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
All right, we're going. Go ahead. I don't care about if Alexis can't get the sound.
Where are
going.
You going? Okay. Sound is rolling, babe.
Oh, since you left?
No, just now.
Okay. It's melting the cup.
No, something else.
I have something else for you.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
I'll take that. Oh, okay. We've got. We're exchanging.
I was afraid of that.
Scalpel. It's melting the cup. Yeah. Did we get that at high speed? It's melting the cup. Anyway, the whole concept behind this is like, we're not putting this, this is not going like, you know, we're not going to cut this like a fucking Entertainment Tonight thing or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's just talk, you know.
Are you guys from Toronto or something?
Yeah, we're totally from it. It's going online. So the, I don't know. I mean, I exchanged some emails about it with you.
Yeah.
But it's really, the idea is to be as conversational as possible. You know, obviously when it's edited, we'll make sure that you never look the way you look right now.
Confused.
Yeah. We want it to meander, and like the audio portion of this is going to be put on an iPodcast.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be me sounding like an old man on an eye. On one of those eye. On the Apple things.
Yeah.
You know the things Apple does? The thing? Anyway. So, again, Hollywood Shuffle, you said, was made with credit. Like, it was only the end that was made with credit cards.
Right.
Kind of an apocryphal story?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, I think, you know, after a couple of years of shooting odd weekends, maybe 10, 12 days total. I think he just wanted it to be done, and, you know, wrote the last of the material and went out and just did it in a number of days, you know, and put it all on different credit cards that were offered to him.
At this point in your career, you're known for what? You're known for...
Nothing.
You're known for nothing. So you're struggling.
Yeah, I mean, I was working as an assistant still, and you know, shooting 16 stuff.
Were you pulling focus a lot?
By the way, I did that once.
That was Alexis. That
wasn't for me.
Yeah, yeah. No. And this is the coffee that was previously poured down. So you're
mostly a second, and then I did one film as a first, right to operating.
What?
Then I switched to be, you know, an operator, which was sort of a difficult transition because you don't.
Well, did you like first thing, or did you hate the tension of it? A lot of people say it's the worst thing in the world to do. And then
it's the hardest job in the movie business. It's gotten easier with digital, where you can actually get some feedback and see if it was sharp.
Right.
But it's, it wasn't for me. So, and then when you start operating, you know, you sort of, you just get day work. You get days here and there.
What made you want to be a DP in the first place?
I just really enjoyed it, and I thought if I could, you know, it wasn't like a job to me, and if I could do that and make a living, then it was better than, you know, working in a bank or something where you dreaded going to work every day.
Right. But I'm saying, as a kid, what's the first thing you noticed? Like, because you have Peter Deming's photography is very interesting, and I've been trying to, like, every person that comes in, I've been trying to figure out a way to talk about it. And often there's a specificity to what they do. Sometimes it's all over the map. Sometimes, they, you know, it's like their talent is that it looks completely different. You know, like, well, there's plenty of examples, but, you know, like one thing that Tom Richmond was here yesterday, not one thing he does looks, you know, anything. And a lot of photographers say, well, you know, I don't want anything I do to look the same as the next thing, because that would be, like me copying myself, right?
Right.
And yet, you know, you look at Gordon Willis's stuff, for example, I'm just focused on him because we interviewed him, and it's like it very affected me. But, like, you know, the opening shot of Clute is very similar to the opening shot of The Godfather, which is very similar to the opening shot of The Great Paper Chase, with this, just get a sense of it, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Peter Deming's photography is like, I keep on wanting to say sourceless, that everything in the room, everything in the photograph has contour and composition, and you're drawn to the right things to tell the story, but then, you know, and it's not soft, but it's not hard, but it's not it's kind of this mid ground, and it's not grainy, but it's not really contrasty, but it's not low contrast, you know, and yet you think about sequences like in Lost Highway, where when Bill Pullman finally is coming around back to his story, and we have the character with the video camera who's his kind of his super ego, his conscience that's coming back, and, you know, I forget the name of the actor with the white face paint.
Robert Blake.
That's right, just the scariest thing alive.
Yeah.
And you've got these flashes of light that are so bright, and then you in Same in Mulholland Drive, you've got these flashes of light, and then in Drag Me to Hell, you know, yes, a lot of the interiors have this Peter Deming thing going on, and then when at the very end of the movie she's dragged off by this burning flame, there's nothing subtle about that. It's extremely, you know, brash, right? So I'm saying, how do you, like, I mean, I'm going a long way out of my way, but I'm saying, let's go back to your influences. What was the thing you noticed in photography that you originally liked? You know,
I think that, I don't know, it's hard to sort of pick out one or two things. I mean, I came up sort of making Super 8 movies when I was a kid,
right.
Also being a still photographer, also sort of watching, you know, one of the first filmmakers who I was sort of conscious of who was making this movie was Orson Welles.
Right.
So, you know, I sort of started looking at his films and just noticing, you know, photography related to story.
Aside from Citizen Kane, give us some of your other
films. Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil,
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's sort of, every film I prep, it's so I start with Touch of Evil. It doesn't matter what it is.
Every film.
It's always in my head, you know. So, but it really comes from storytelling and how, like you say, you know, no two films should really look the same. You know, there's certain things that you gravitate towards because you think they're effective, or you find them pleasing, or whatever that may, you know, reoccur from time to time in your work. But I think most cinematographers would say, you know, I don't want to repeat myself, you know, you can maybe take elements of things you did in other films and mix it with something new, and you know,
yeah,
and do it that way. I mean, and I think that now with, you know, different capture technologies and post technologies, you can, you know, stretch that even further. Yeah.
So now, you know, Hollywood Shuffle is a milestone for you. You get noticed in the business when it's released, at least for being a part with this. What was the thing that you think put you on the map?
Well, I think, you know, that and Evil Dead 2 came out
right
within a few, couple months of each other.
It was your first work with Sam Raimi.
Yeah. And obviously two completely different movies.
Yes.
You know, one got a lot of sort of mainstream press. You know, Hollywood Shuffle, you know, was like this sort of easy to promote story, filmmaking story.
Yeah.
And, you know, the film's quite funny, and it, you know, so whenever people look at your resume and they've actually heard of the film that you did, it always helps, you know. Yeah, so yeah. That and, you know, Sam's thing was a little more culty, you know, a little more cinematic maybe.
Right.
So you sort of cover a couple bases there right away. And it was probably a year and a half, 2 years after that, that I stopped being an operator and just shooting, you know. There was still that transition of being an operator on bigger films, shooting smaller films, and
were you an operator on what were some of the bigger movies you were an operator on?
I used to work with Fred Murphy a little bit.
Oh yeah, we're actually trying to get him in.
That's yeah, funny. And I operated on a film called Stars and Bars. Most of it, you know, most of it. An independent film at that time, the DP operated. So you were like a day player on B camera, C camera.
Right.
You know, so rarely would you do a whole film as an operator. And right when I was sort of getting to that point, I decided to stop doing it and concentrate on shooting full time.
What did the experience of operating give to you creatively, and what did it give to you in terms of working environment? I'm saying like, or managerial. Like you're seeing the way other DPs do things,
right?
And you can't help but pick up,
right?
You know, well.
Yeah, I mean, everything I was shooting, I was operating. But then you know, operating, you know, once you set up the shot, it's really just when you turn the camera on and off. You know, when you're operating for someone else, you can sort of think about the shot more, maybe fine tune it, maybe watch what, you know, the person you're working for is doing.
Yeah.
And be more conscious of the environment than if you're shooting and operating at the same time.
Did you have any experiences where you were like, you know, somebody told you frame it this way, and you're like, huh? And then you saw it, and you went, oh, I guess maybe.
Yeah, both that way and the other way. Like, you know, when I said, I went, yeah, maybe I should have done it the way I wanted. You know, but but that's, you know, that's what makes this business interesting. Everyone has an opinion and a style, and there's, you know, nobody's right. It's just what's right for you, you know.
Right. So you make the transition. You get Evil Dead 2. You shoot Evil Dead 2, which is quite stylish. And what's the experience of working with Sam Raimi, who is one of the ultimate visual storytellers of our generation?
Right. It's pretty fun. I mean, it's sort of every day is you sort of, well, on that film, you know, we sort of gathered and at breakfast and went over the shots, and Sam would draw little stick figures, you know, frames. And but it was a little different for me because I came into that film 2 weeks into shooting. So, you know, I didn't really get any prep. So it was just sort of thrown into the mix and, you know.
You're thinking, I was kind of thinking I'd light it like this, does that sound good?
Well, no, I mean, we looked at what was shot, you know, we had conversations about the look that he was going for, and, you know, during the first couple weeks, you sort of fine-tune that, and it's more about, it's a little bit more about the complexity of the shots that he's doing, you know. We would shoot forward, we'd shoot backwards,
right.
You know, rarely did we shoot 24 frames a second.
Rarely.
Yeah, I mean, the poor sound guy, you know, some days he wouldn't even roll anything because we're in like 20 frames or 21. You know, it's all guide track of, you know, monsters grunting and stuff they ultimately won't use, but would help them in post. So, you know, and we didn't have, this was 86, so they didn't have the money or the technology to sort of reverse everything in post, and, you know.
Right.
So we did, all that stuff was in camera.
Wow.
Almost all of it.
And are you, like, just in love with this, the way he's shaping shots and like edits, essentially, like the way he wants
yeah.
to tell
Yeah, me. I mean, it's it was really a thrill ride. You know, it's very dynamic,
yeah.
And he was really interested in keeping it going and sort of steering the audience a certain way through the camera.
Any particular reason why you didn't shoot Army of Darkness?
I think it was on another movie.
Okay.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
No. This is my boomstick. Yeah, that's the ultimate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, okay, so you, what's the next milestone for you in the course of the...
I don't know.
I'm going to look it up. I'll look it up here.
I can't remember that far back.
I'll pull it up here. All right, so we get... Well, I'm going to take a guess. Well, first of all, you were second unit on Dark Band. But that
right.
probably isn't a big one. I mean, it takes two Scarecrows, Purple People Eater, Martian to Go Home, House Party.
House Party was probably...
Yeah. How did you get that job?
I'm not really sure. You know, maybe some of it was Hollywood Shuffle and Evil Dead 2 because
right.
Reggie, you know, was sort of had a lot of, I won't say influences, but interest in film, you know, sort of outside of quote unquote black cinema, which I don't know why we even use,
we use
term.
That term anymore.
Yeah. So, but yeah, they came to me and, you know, it was,
It was black cinema, then it became urban, and now
right.
they'll find some other euphemism. For,
I mean, when you look at it now, I mean, it's basically,
racist.
It's, yeah. you know, it's, you know, maybe a little bit, it's like Pretty in Pink with a little more edge.
Right.
You know, it's not that out there.
No.
Interesting thing about that film, that was entirely shot, entirely edited on tape.
Really?
We had no dailies.
Linear
sort thing. Of linear. I mean, it was this system called Montage.
Oh, that was like a partner to Edit Droid, almost like a follow up to Edit Droid, where it's like you had 14 decks or whatever.
Oh, they had about 50 decks.
And then they would all you would make a cut, and then it would go.
I mean, I think they had, you know, a scene in each deck or something. And when right. I went to the cutting room, it was sort of unbelievable. But the upshot of this, I we never printed dailies. You know, and this is what 89. I think we shot that and. So I never saw the film until we did
the
answer
print. Shot the whole movie without...
You know, black cast at night, you know, short schedule, and I'm just exposing, and, you know, it's showing up on tape, but I don't have printer lights, I don't have anything,
right.
you know, to go on. Occasionally I'd ask the lab to put it up, you know, on a timer and say what they would print it at, you know. If you were printing it, which they didn't, where would you print this? So...
There's a scene in that movie, Kid and Play, right?
Yeah.
No, I forget which one was Kid and which one was Play, but the...
That's the, Kid.
Kid.
Yeah.
Kid, they each have a girl that they want to, you know, connect with.
Mm-hmm.
And I say connect with not to be euphemistic. Like, it's not just screw. It's actually, they actually have crushes. And
right.
It's actually quite a mature picture. And I remember in the review that Roger and Ebert gave... They said this is actually a touching movie.
Right.
Right? Anyway, he gets alone with her in a bedroom, and they decide they're going to have sex.
Right.
And then he has a condom that he's
right.
playing with, and a couple things happen in the scene. One, there's kind of a visual gag that's kind of, you know, a little bit spoofy, because, you know, this condom is melted or whatever, it's in his pocket.
Right.
And then she's sort of... There's a two-shot of them, I think, when he's sitting on the bed and she's sort of kissing his shoulder or
right.
his neck or
right.
something like that. And she's saying, it's okay, you know, I guess we can't do it. He's disappointed. And the scene manages to be both realistic, a little bit stylized, but very, very, very human. Like, it's a very emotionally normal... that you don't, even today, you don't get a lot of that, where
mm-hmm.
it's very realistic... And you feel like it's actually accessing what people would do in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of, it gives a lot of credibility. Almost the writing gave a lot of credibility. Do you want to talk about shooting that scene? About what you're going for stylistically, or you know?
As I recall, I mean, my sort of main concern with the scene was that it not be overlit and not look phony. And, you know, they're supposed to snuck upstairs in her house at night, you know, so I didn't want a lot of lights on in the room, and I wanted to sort of play it moody, which, you know, probably if I saw it now, I would say it's not, but, but you know, I remember one shot we did, I think it was a two-shot against the drapes, you know, at night, and so I said to Reggie, well, why don't we just play it like, you know, just porch light or street light on the drape and let them go pretty dark, you know. And so he was off for that. And I think, as I recall, we sort of half lit them. And I just wanted it to feel like they could actually go through with this act. You know, and it wasn't like a sitcom situation, you know. So from a photography standpoint, that's what I recall about it.
Well, it's a beautiful scene. It's a beautiful scene. It's also it's kind of a movie people should take another look at. I think the only thing that's distracting about it now is that the styles, the billowy shirts and everything, is so dated.
Yeah.
But maybe within a few more years, people will be able to look at it with that.
Well, in a few more years, they'll probably be back to that style.
So. Yeah, anyway.
And then it'll be cool again.
That's true. You'll probably be wearing that.
Not likely.
Okay, so moving forward a little bit. How much of Species was shot in Los Angeles?
A fair amount. I'm not sure where the location work was done. I sort of went in towards the end of their stage.
Is it true Robert Rodriguez actually vied to be like a second unit on that? Or?
I have no idea. Okay. I wasn't that involved in it. I sort of came in towards the end and did some specialty shots, and then next thing you know, Andre was on a plane and I was finishing the movie.
Okay. You weren't the actual photographer, you weren't the main, you know, I mean, with Cousin Vinny, we should talk about my Cousin Vinny a little bit. Here's another movie, shares a relationship with House Party a little bit, in as much as it's a comedy, mm-hmm. but with a very, I mean, it didn't get Academy Award nominations of any kind, because it was just sort of like a straight up.
Well, you know, no, that's not true. Marissa won for Best Supporting.
No, I'm saying it wouldn't have gotten.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It got Academy Award nominations.
Oh, because it was, yeah.
It wouldn't, just if it was just a comedy, a throwaway comedy.
Right.
It wouldn't have just, you know, received, it had enough.
Yes.
Serious, like, actual impact.
Right.
Not because it was a drama or anything, but just because it was so well written and so well executed.
Yeah.
So, tell us about when you're making this movie, I mean, obviously the title's My Cousin Vinny. I think everyone that went to the theater thought, okay, because you know we're gonna
right, right,
and then you get in there and this thing just doesn't let you go. It's
right,
just like it
right.
Grabs you, doesn't let you go with phenomenal performances all across the board.
I think it's a film that, like you say, it was very well written, and you know, sort of casts to its strengths of the characters. I mean, you read that character of Vinny, and you know, Pesci's just perfect for it. You know,
right.
So much of that is him. And Marissa, you know, we didn't know much about Marissa. I think she just did a film with John Landis at the time.
Uh-huh.
And so there's, you know, there's sort of no persona coming with her. So she had that advantage where she could become a character and no one had any preconceptions about her. But she pretty much, you know, nailed that one.
Oh, yeah.
I think. Yeah.
What was your biggest challenge on that movie, technically or creatively?
It's hard to say. You know, sometimes compositionally it was challenging. You know, when your leading man is probably 5'1", 5'2", you
right.
know. Yeah, I remember one scene we had... it was Joe and Fred Gwynne. Fred Gwynne's about 6'11", 7 feet tall. You
playing
know, and
the
judge. He was the judge. And,
yeah. What does he eat?
And they had a walk and talk down a hallway. And, you know, I sat down with Jonathan Lynn, the director, and I said, how are we going to do this? You know, it's like, it's going to have to be so wide. It's going to be not, you know, I don't know if it's going to play for the dialogue.
Right.
So we ended up building up one side of the hallway for Joe that was out of frame, you know, and shot in such a way where it still obviously had a big height difference, but it was manageable for that shot.
So you actually had to build like a whole riser.
Ramp, yeah.
This is the fun.
This is not the
fun. You still haven't tasted the real, the full deal. That's getting close.
Okay. Is it the loading dock?
Yeah. So it was like dead quiet. We show up here, we set up, it's dead quiet, right? And then Sam, this is awesome, you know, this is great. And then Sam Levy shows up, right? I don't know if you know him, he's a really great young DP. And start talking, and this happens 7 or 8 times.
Right.
But the best is like when it comes in and then it goes back.
Right.
So it's just, common, you know, anyway. Talk about the scene lighting the courtroom. We actually have a red Scarlet. We own a red, and we are using it on other projects. But it just became like for this, it just became ridiculous. Like,
yeah.
You don't really realize, like, I mean, until you know, like, there's a difference between owning equipment and renting equipment.
Yeah,
it's a big difference. Yeah. Once you own it, you actually realize what situations it. You know, like a camera isn't a camera, it's a camera that can get really bulked up and just anyway. So I was going to ask you about the courtroom. I think is there any DP that walks into a courtroom and goes? Into a courtroom and doesn't go, shit, how do I make this different?
Yeah, well, there was on that one, we actually built that. That was probably one of the first sort of studio builds that, you know, I had to deal with. And unfortunately, it was in a warehouse, so we didn't have, you know, as much space as we would have liked, both outside the set and above. In fact, when it rained, we had to stop because it was so loud. Not unlike, you know, where we are now.
The offices of film films, thank you very much.
But it's, and certainly when I look at it now, I would do a lot of things differently. But it's sort of balancing, you know, sort of the typical dramatic courtroom you would see, you know, and then sort of tempering that to fit in this movie, you know, for a comedy. So, and we had different, you know, we did different lighting conditions. This one day, I think, in the story where it's supposed to be raining, you know, we had a trans light shot, you know, that put out the window.
Right.
So it was, you know, once we got it set up, it was fairly comfortable.
And now your approach to working with Jonathan, your approach to framing, you know, are you a wide lens guy? Are you a long lens guy? Whatever it suits the moment or the.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends on the story. You know, he had a lot more experience in comedy than I did, and you know, he believed in sort of letting the comedy happen, which I agree with. You know, but I think you still have to make it cinematic, or it's too much. Like a 3-camera TV show, you know. So we actually sat down in prep and went through the entire movie and did floor plans and shot lists and talked about specific shots in the courtroom, you know, where I think we both felt like we had to spice it up a little bit or it was going to really drag. So we looked at other courtroom dramas and sort of picked out shots that we liked and adapted them to fit the story.
You mentioned twice so far. You said I would certainly do it differently now.
Yeah.
How often is that? Do you look back at your work and like? There's two types of artists. There's guys who like what they do and there's guys who hate what they do. I tend to think most, you know, A lot of them, and there's no predicting, you know what I mean? Like, there's no predicting. Some people can be very confident, some people can be great and bad, good, you know, and still love what they do or hate what they do. You know, there's all cross sections. Do you look back at everything you do and go, ugh?
Sometimes I cringe, yeah. I mean, it's particularly the, you know, stuff sort of early on where you're sort of probably playing it more safe than you would now. You know, you take much more, you know, as you get more experience, you sort of know what chances you can take and which ones you can't, and your tastes change, obviously. You know, anyone who tells you, you know, that they wouldn't change anything about any of their movies is probably lying.
Right.
And the things that you change about those movies also changes over time. You know, sometimes you like it, sometimes you hate it. But, you know, and there's still things that you shoot that you look at and you, you know, maybe there's certainly scenes that I wouldn't change in certain films. Uh-huh. But, you know, I would say rarely on a whole do you go out and shoot a movie and you have that movie in your head. Rarely do you accomplish everything that you imagine.
Yeah.
You know, occasionally it happens to maybe 70 or 80%, and that's pretty great.
Yeah.
Because there's so many factors against you.
Yeah. So some people said it's a miracle that anything ever gets shot.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah,
because,
yeah.
I mean, you go out there and it's like, if you can't, it's this factor and that factor and this, you know, it's like trying to serve breakfast when there's a tornado in the house, you know?
Yeah.
Just...
Yeah, my eggs are cold.
Yeah, exactly. To get over and have the table and have the plates put down and have the food ready is like, it's impossible.
Right.
So, were there any films that you shot that were just, you know, one, like, well, let's start with disastrous experiences. Was there any, I mean, if you don't want to talk about that, we could cut
probably not, but we'll try it.
Yeah. Is there any films that you had that were, that you just weren't happy with the way anything looked in the movie? Even though the audience may have thought it looked great.
I'd have to look. Yeah, let me look. I can't remember. It's too... Oh, no password.
That was good. Oh, I see.
No, I mean, I don't think there's anything visually disastrous.
Right.
No. You know, I think there has to be something there when you take the job that interests you about whether, you know, hopefully it's the story and the photography comes out of that.
How do you go about selecting your scripts?
Well, it depends on where you are sort of in the career timeline. You know, at first you just do anything you can. And then you sort of, I mean, I gravitate towards stories that I like, you know. Sometimes they're visual, sometimes they're not. You know, you can always make them more visual than they appear on paper, depending on, you know, who you're working with, who you're collaborating with. But, you know, so to me it starts from either a funny story or a compelling story or a dramatic story, whatever it is. And, you know, maybe there's set pieces within the script that you're interested in. You know, it sort of builds from there,
right.
You know.
So let's talk a bit about, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, but how does Lost Highway, how does David Lynch come into your life? Or how do you come into his?
Well, I was, I'm trying to remember, I'd finished something. Oh, it was actually after My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah.
Which
is a natural fit that David Lynch
didn't
want that.
No, I sort of had a long break.
Yeah.
And it was... a production manager that I'd worked with when I was an assistant, and I hadn't seen or talked to her in probably
20 years.
No, 6-7 years.
Oh, okay.
You know, called me out of the blue and said she was working on. David did a series called On the Air after Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And they had shot the pilot, and they were picked up for 6 episodes, and they were looking for someone to shoot them. And, you know, I'd never done episodic television. It wasn't really, you know, I wasn't looking to. But, you know, obviously this was in the right company. So
So
I went in and met on it. And I met David briefly and then...
What was that meeting like?
It was very simple. You know, he just sort of asked me a few questions. And, you know, I was sort of meeting a lot of people in the office at the same time. So, you know, it was great to meet him, and, you know, it's very brief.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting the job, but David really wasn't around. He was posting Firewalk with me.
Uh-huh.
So, but it was a group of directors that, you know, were pretty interesting, like Jack Fisk and Betty Thomas and Jonathan Sanger and Leslie Glatter.
Wow.
You know, so, and I think a couple of them did two episodes. So, but it was pretty brutal shooting. You know, it was like 4 days to shoot a half-hour show. It was all stage-based, so that really helped. And then once I finished that, I'm trying to think of the timeline. It's probably about 6 months later, David called me, and he was doing a sort of a omnibus for HBO called Hotel Room. And he was directing two of the three episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first time I actually got to work with him. And then we did a bunch of commercials and sort of, you know, a few years went
by. David Lynch commercials, the ones that are like only David Lynch could have made that commercial?
Some of them, yeah.
One of them, the one about New York and the...
oh, no, I didn't do that.
You didn't do that one?
The litter
yeah. of New York. Which no, that is like was the, before. Is like the creepiest fucking commercial ever yeah. made, right?
No, these were like, most of them out of Europe for like perfume and, you know, running shoes. And
tell us about one of the commercials, just what happens in the commercial.
There was one, well, a couple. The one that was a perfume commercial, and we yeah. shot in the desert. We shot in the studio, and it was just sort of about, you know, they sort of let him get away with whatever he wanted
whatever
to
he
do.
Wants, yeah.
And he had ideas about the structure. You know, he had certain boards he had to shoot, but we would just do a lot of experimentation with smoke and, you know, off speed and, you know, lightning machines. And, you know, we did a thing out in the desert with this thing called the lictopodium machine, which is basically shooting magnesium into the air and igniting it, you know, in the middle of the night out in the desert. It was pretty interesting. And I think some of that sort of laid the groundwork for some of the stuff we eventually did in Lost Highway.
What was the concept of that commercial? Like, just if you were to describe it.
It was a man and a leopard, you know, who meet and create this fragrance. That's about all I could sort of tell you.
Yeah, I'm thinking David Lynch should be the one to pull that, yeah.
So it was always sort of, you know, just gather all the tools, not sure what's going to happen, you know. I always liken David to a painter, you know, as a filmmaker, where
yep.
you have all the tools you need, and you sort of have an idea of what you want, but it doesn't become fully realized until the day of.
And, okay, and talking about that, you know, I've watched some extensive interviews with Mr. Lynch, and he's very clear on what he's doing. Like, he doesn't reveal his tastes, he just reveals what he's doing, the practicals of what he's doing.
It right. seems.
And he said one time, I think, that mood is achieved through three things. The way things are arranged in front of the camera, the lighting, mm-hmm. and sound. Now, obviously, when you're shooting, you don't know that he's going to be creating a rumble. I mean, the first time I played Mulholland Drive, I did it in a home theater that was well set up, and
right.
the rumble was so powerful that it was like the walls were,
right.
were literally crevicing. You can't know that when you're shooting it. You don't, you know.
No, I mean, sometimes he'll mention things like that. You know, there were a couple scenes in Lost Highway that he had already picked out the music for. And when we were shooting those scenes, that music was playing, like, definitely loud while you're rolling and the actors are doing their thing, you know.
Yeah.
And when you see the movie, for me, when I see those scenes in the movie, you know, it's just how, it's the exact environment we shot it in.
Can you give me an example?
Two. One was the love scene with Patricia and Bill in front of the car. That song from Chris and Cozy was, I mean, he had big rock and roll speakers out there, and he was blasting that music. And there was no direction. It was just the music, and, you know, and the camera was rolling, and just, you know. And the other was when Baltazar was in the walking down the hallway of the Lost Highway Hotel, and you had this like Rammstein, this German industrial music playing.
Yeah.
And we literally had a speaker, huge speaker, on the dolly that was cranked all the way up as we're dollying down this hallway.
Did it change Balthazar Getty's performance?
It changed everyone. I mean, the dolly grip, everybody was feeding off this. You know, it was pretty great.
David is there.
Well, he was probably at the end of the hallway with a megaphone, trying to be heard.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And is there ever moments when you get to set, or you've read the script, and you're reading the script, and you know you're shooting whatever today, and you don't know how Mr. Lynch is going to want to do it, and then all of a sudden, when you see it, you go, oh.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you give me an example? I mean, I have an example, and I want to hear an example.
Well, it's the very first day on Lost Highway. There was a scene in... It was Patricia and Bill in the living room, and the dialogue's very like, oh, hi, you know, I have to work tonight, you know, it's sort of...
He's a musician.
Yeah.
He's suspicious of his
wife. Are you going to come down to the club? Not really. Well, none of that's in the script. It's just the dialogue that you hear. And it seems very cheery when you read it. You know, day interior, living room, you know, 50s suburban ranch house.
Right.
This dialogue between a man and a wife, and so we sort of, you know, got there and got it going, sort of half lit, and then they rehearsed it, and then when we saw the scene, I just turned, I said, I'm going to need a little more time, and it was just, like you say, there was so much tension between those two people, and so much backstory, in the exact lines that I had read in the script, nothing changed, that I had to relight the scene much darker, much moodier. Because it didn't, what we were doing, what we were thinking, didn't at all fit what David was, how he was directing the act.
Did he tell you to relight it, or did you just go, I got to redo this now?
No, I didn't tell him I was lit. I said, you know, we just threw some stuff up, and I wasn't lit. You know,
right.
We were sort of getting there.
Yeah.
But we ended up turning a lot of things off.
It's funny you mention that, because that set, and the scenes that play out in that set, there's kind of, it's been a few years, but... There's some transitions, almost like ships passing in the night, mm-hmm. when he's still considering, you know. I mean, I heard, as a backup, David Lynch talks about that this is inspired by O.J. You know, he saw the Bronco going down the street, he saw the footage, and this is what inspired this movie, right? And he said, I think he said something to the tune of, things happen, people do things, and then their mind doesn't want to accept what they've done, so they invent something else. So when I watch the movie now, and again, like, everyone wants to explain David Lynch movies, and sometimes they need no explanation, they're beautiful text, they're, you know, whatever, and sometimes you can just, for the sake of argument, say, well, this is what is happening, or whatever.
It's right.
Some basic causality plot way, right? So, from that regard, Bill, we should give this uncut to this. Yeah. So, from that perspective, Bill Pullman figures out his wife's cheating on him, and then does something, presumably kills her, and then creates this alternate reality idea in his head of him being Balthazar Getty, where he's young and he's attractive and everyone wants him. I don't know if that's the way you saw the story or not, or the way David saw the story, but that's what I get out of it.
Uh-huh.
And then, and again, this is all relevant because there's nothing to do with actually absorbing the compelling story that's put in front of you, but... So that being said, in the period of the beginning of the movie, where there's this tension growing, there seems to be like sort of like ships passing in the night between Pullman and his wife,
mm-hmm.
and it gets darker and darker. And I remember very sparse furniture. There's a side table, mm-hmm. a very weird side table
that David made. Yeah,
that David had that made.
No, he made it himself. He's a very accomplished carpenter. He's got a whole wood shop. Makes furniture all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Can I get him to make me a chair?
It'd be real expensive.
Does he charge for his furniture? Or?
There was a company that was going to sort of produce it and sell it. I don't know if that ever happened, but I remember in the film there's a little table at the top of the stairs that's like triangular with a phone on it. He definitely made that one.
That's the one I'm talking about.
And I think the coffee table he may have made.
Which is also bizarre.
Yeah.
It kind of had a lacquer, weird lacquer finish,
I
think. Yeah. But then you have put in, along with these weird angles, and this house that becomes almost like a and trapping in a way. You put in these shafts of light. It starts a little bit lit, and then it gets more and more and more shafty. Was that conscious? Was that a conscious choice?
A little bit. I mean, you just want to sort of show certain parts of the room, you know, and then you just let the shadows get deeper and deeper. And some of it was just the physicality of the house. I mean, you see in one shot where he comes out when he, you know, very early when he hears the front buzzer and he runs out and you're behind him and you see these little windows.
Yeah.
There's two little windows and that's pretty much it. You know, and thankfully David put in a skylight or it would have been tough just to light it, you know, to see it. But those windows sort of allowed us to just pick up little parts of the room.
Right. And now, in this process of shooting these scenes, I'm just focusing on the house. There's a wonderful moment where he comes downstairs and to the front steps. And I think there's a package or the paper after the videotape or something.
Yeah, she comes down, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. In the moments of making this, these sequences, what comes first? Your lighting, your framing? Is David very specific on how he wants the camera to be and where to move? Is it a mutual thing? Does it just kind of find itself? Is it blocking based? Like, how is it coming together?
I think it's, you know, it comes out of the rehearsal, you know, something specific David wants to do with the camera or the size of the shot, you know, we'll talk about that. You know, pick a lens and whatever the movement is, and then compositionally, you know, usually he just lets me do it, and if he comments on it, he does. If he doesn't, then I'm assuming it's all okay. You know, before I worked with David, of course, I was a big fan and watched everything that he'd done many times, so I felt like I knew his taste.
Freddie Holmes shoes.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I knew his taste somewhat, and we sort of were on the same page of things that we like personally. And so it wasn't a big stretch, you know, it wasn't a big learning curve. There's certainly a learning curve, but it wasn't huge, right. You know, so, yeah, I mean, that was pretty much it.
How is the effect achieved now, first of all, when it goes to the Belvedere Getty story, when we transition also into a mechanic shop, and there's a mobster's wife, girlfriend, and
right.
All that stuff, it feels like there's kind of a glow over the story. Was that some kind of filtration, or was it?
You mean when you go from the prison cell to the prison cell?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
It was a thing we started because we shot out a sequence. It was a thing we started. We were shooting a scene with Balthazar in his bedroom. Right before his friends come over. And we had, two things happened. One, we had set up a dolly shot, and we had dollied in to the end, you know, it was a, sort of a move-in like that. So we had dollied all the way in, and I had locked the camera off. And we said, okay, we're ready to shoot. They took the camera back to the first mark, but the camera was still locked where it was. So the end composition, when you got there, was the wall and, you know, the room, and then down here in the corner was Balthazar's head and shoulders. And David just saw it on the monitor and said, that's how we're shooting this. And that's how we shot it, and that's what's in the movie. And then that same scene, I think after that shot, we were changing lenses. And we're shooting with anamorphics, which are a little bigger than most lenses.
Yep.
And they were sort of were sticky going in and out of the camera.
You shot that anamorphic 2.35.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because I think the version, maybe the DVD release was 1.85.
The original one that came out, which is sort of a bootleg version, is. The one came out, I think, last year or the year before, that's sort of more authorized and much better quality. That's 2.35.
Now I feel cheated.
Yeah, you missed a lot of the movie.
Oh, crap. and so what stopped?
The assistant was trying to put the lens in, and it kept getting stuck, and he kept pulling it out and putting it back in. And David was watching the monitor and fell in love with that effect. So we started doing that. You know, there's a shot in that scene where he's looking at the ceiling light, and we're sort of moving up towards it at the same time the assistant's pulling the lens in and out of the camera. While he's pulling focus, I don't know how he did it. So we started doing that.
Physically removing
yeah.
the,
while the camera's rolling. So we started doing that in Baltazar's section of the movie. So when it came to the transition, David just wanted to throw it way out of focus, and it wouldn't go out of focus enough. So we ended up pulling the lens out a little bit, just holding it there for that effect in the cell.
Because it just wasn't bokeh enough-ish.
No, it wasn't.
Wow.
Wasn't soft enough.
That's amazing. This is really like taking the camera and beating it up to get what you want.
Yeah.
Okay, so at the end of the movie, at the end of this wonderfully dark and haunting story, we go back to Bill Pullman, and he is now being chased by police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a sequence of shots that's almost like if you and I are talking, and you're the nice guy that you are, and then as you leave, you turn to me and you punch me in the face five
uh-huh.
times.
Uh-huh.
That's what it felt like, visually. It felt like being kicked in the face.
Right.
Almost that you as an audience member were guilty of not doing enough.
Which we did once in the movie when he was being interrogated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. What? How did you achieve those effects? I mean, there's this almost high-speed shot that the lights are flying by, and it's just like all of a sudden, like, holy shit, you know, like it makes you realize that nothing was by accident in this movie, and that if you wanted to, you could have shot like an action movie if you really wanted to, you know.
Right, right.
But it was, you know, it's just like it just comes like out of nowhere, right? And you're energized by it.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, there's, as I recall, a particularly aggressive song, you know, soundtrack for that.
Yeah.
And we see the car go by. It's sort of dawn, and we basically shot Bill in the car with all the cop cars behind him, and we had it's like I was mentioning earlier. I mean, you go out with the tools and you put them all together, and then David just sort of orchestrates it,
right?
You know, to what he feels at the moment, I think, you know, or what the emotion of the scene is, you know. And it was, but we had so much stuff. We needed so much power for that shot because we had big carbon arc, DC carbon arcs, lightning machines, and strobe lights, and, you know, just the regular lighting plus the camera. And so it was literally a generator truck with a flatbed that was towing Bill Pullman's car. And we're driving around in the desert in the middle of the night.
Do you own the highway that you're shooting on?
I think so. I mean, it was so desolate. You didn't have to worry about it. You know, it's probably 3 or 4 in the morning. And, you know, these lighting effects are going off. There's strobe lights in the car. There's lighting machines outside of the car. You know, I think there are 4 or 5 cop cars behind him providing some depth to the shot.
Yes.
And David just, you know, directing Bill through the radio, and we just shot a bunch of stuff. And what they ended up doing, which I thought was very effective, was blowing it up. To get closer to him, they blew it up. And it, as it, of course you do, it gets more and more grainy, which I think added to the aggression of it. And, you know, it's sort of this place where the song comes to a crescendo, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all sort of...
How did you achieve the effect with his face?
We did a lot of off-speed. You know, we shot like 20 frames or 18. I think we went down to 12.
Right.
Maybe 8 or 10, you know, and they just played around with that in the cutting room.
And as far as punching the police lamps, because they sort of punch out.
Yeah. No, we didn't do anything special. I mean, normally in a case like that, photography, you knock them down because they're way too bright.
Oh, I see. Oh, because you had the bird arcs.
Well, because, you know, it was sort of a surreal...
Let's just keep talking now, because we're talking about David Lynch, so let's talk.
I mean, it's sort of a surreal moment, so, you know, I sort of didn't want to lose them. I wanted them to... And, you know, we used nets behind the lens on that movie, the whole movie, and so that sort of grabs... points of light like that, it sort of stretches them.
Stretches them, right, okay.
You know, and the anamorphics do the same thing. They stretch horizontally. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, it sort of all combines to...
Which anamorphics were you using, out of curiosity?
We were using the primarily E-Series Panavision.
E-Series, okay.
And then we had some... That's good.
Yeah.
We had some C-Series for Steadicam.
Right, because they're a little bit lighter. Or...
Yeah, it's much smaller and lighter.
Right. are you a panty guy, or...?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, started... They caught me about 89, I think, and then they had me.
any particular lenses of yours that are favorites that are always on your
show? Well, an anamorphic, the 65 is my favorite.
What? Just out of curiosity, the 65, because of the bigger area about the squeeze, mathematically, it's the lens equivalent on a Super 35 of what?
It's different. It's sort of like a 50 millimeter is the height of a 50, but the width of a 25.
Right. Okay.
You know, so 65's like, you know, the height of a 65, but the width of a 35.
Right. Okay.
Or a 40. Or
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. Got it. Well, Lost Highway, one of the great.
It was fun. That was fun.
And I don't. And I think in years to come. Well, let's talk about the ultimate movie that gets appreciated and then reappreciated, and starts to, like a fine wine, just keep on blossoming. Mulholland Drive. We can talk. You know, obviously, there's the stories about the fact that it started out as a TV movie or a TV series
pilot.
It's gonna be a pilot. Then they decided they would. You know, David Lynch tells a story about Mulholland Drive is this winding road that takes a lot of twists and turns, and the project itself took very bizarre twists and turns to get to where it did. When it comes to understanding the story of that one, not that I would ever say, oh, by the way, there's a magazine article, but there happens to be a Salon article that very interestingly analyzes how that movie functions, that the whole first two-thirds of the movie is a reinvented dream of Naomi Watts.
Mm-hmm.
Was that ever discussed between you and Mr. Lynch, or was it just...
No, because the first two-thirds of the movie was the pilot, for the most part.
Okay.
And the last act, last third, was what we shot a year and a half later. So, you know, you can say, well, over the course of the series, however many seasons it's going to run, maybe you would get to that third act... Eventually, I don't know, and I suspect David didn't really know. But what we knew, you know, when we shot the pilot, what we knew that there was a lot going on below the surface of these people that we would eventually find out. You know, we would often turn to David and say, Betty's going to turn bad, isn't she? And he wouldn't say anything. He'd just sort of smile. And the interesting thing is that he was able to take the pilot, which was so open-ended, and there were a lot of other storylines that had to, you know, be sacrificed for the movie, and then transition it into another third act that doesn't really wrap it up, but sort of explains the first two-thirds.
Yeah, or turns them on their
right.
Turns them on their keister.
Right.
A couple sequences I want to talk about in the movie. First thing, you said regarding Lost Highway, you came on to set, the dialogue was all nice, and then you see the way it's playing with the subtext, and you go,
right,
holy shit, this is not what I expected. And then Mr. Lynch does the same thing to us in this movie. We see Betty rehearsing the scene with... rehearsing the scene that she's going to go audition for with, forgetting the name,
Laura. Rita in the movie.
We see Naomi Watts rehearsing the scene with Laura.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this scene between a man and a woman having coffee. It's nothing, right? Then we go into the audition room where she auditions. And without any warning, the audition between Naomi and...
He just passed away, actually. Chad Everett.
Chad Everett. He's like a George Hamilton
look-alike.
You know, they go into the audition room, and the scene is again played out between Naomi and Chad Everett. And all of a sudden, this tremendous intimacy and desperation comes over the scene. And you feel like an idiot. You feel like, you know, like both a magic trick's been done before you. And did you see that coming? Was it in the script at all that this would play out completely differently? Was it, I mean...
No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, with David, as I recall, his screenplays, you know, there's very little description beyond where you are, what time of day it is, how old the people are, and then you have the dialogue, you know, so... You know, I often sort of thought it would be a good directing workshop to write 3 pages of dialogue without any description and give it to people and have them direct it with different backstories. So, no, there was no real indication of that. And, you know, when we just talked about it for a second, I mean, we both felt like the photography should sort of play it straight there and just present the scene in the environment that you've created and let the actors take over. And I think for a lot of people, they don't even realize it's the same dialogue until you point it out. Yeah. I mean, it's so completely different. I mean, because when she's rehearsing, she's, you know, saying it sort of flippantly and...
Completely flippantly.
And she's sort of intimating what a bad scene it is, you know?
Yeah,
and then when you see it played out, it's, of course, completely the opposite.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what David does all the time, you know, where it's sort of that clinic of how you take the same lines of dialogue and make and show that you're a director, you know, and make it work.
And he, the emergence, I mean, the one thing I like to say about Mulholland Drive, or that I've come to in recent years, is that this is a movie that, there are movies that feel dated. There are movies that... 10 years after you watch them, or 20 years after you watch them, they don't lose something, but they just feel like they're right. Pinpointed to a time, and that you have to excuse the film with the lens of
right
context.
That was then, yeah.
Yeah, that was then context. This movie, not only does it not feel contextual, it feels like an unbelievably engrossing story that will play out now, 20 years from now, 40 years from now. But if you took the same movie and you went back in time in a time machine and showed it to somebody from the 50s, nothing would really throw them other than the way it throws everyone when they watch the movie because of how bizarre the content is. Were you conscious of shooting it almost like a 1950s... you know, like very composed, and you know, when we talk about Naomi Watts emerging from the airport, you know, it's almost like there's a little bit of filtration there. I don't know if there was or there wasn't.
Probably a little bit, yeah.
A little bit, and she walks out, and it just feels like it's almost like a Hollywood picture. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Was there an element of almost like mocking Hollywood with your photography, or is that?
No, not consciously. Okay. You know, I think it's. For that film, you know, David talked very much about the emotions of the scenes, you know, particularly when she arrives, you know, he wanted her to come out into this sunlight and not have it be, not bleach it out, but have it be quite bright, you know, because that's one of the things about Los Angeles that strikes everybody when they go there. And, you know, it's just sort of, I remember there was a scene in... you know, at the apartment when David would say, well, you know, this is, despite what's going on here, it's a happy scene, you know, but in the middle, a cloud covers the sun, and then it, on these lines, and then it passes, you know. So you would come up with some sort of lighting effect for that. So it's very much sort of, you know, based upon the emotion, how bright or how shadowy we would make stuff.
Right. And then the movie gets completely stylized when we talk about going into the theater. And not only that, but right off the beginning with the actual sign Mulholland Drive, how did you achieve that effect? Because I think when anyone watches that, they just go, oh, you know, it's just so breathtaking.
Well, it's, you know, David lives not far from Mulholland Drive, you know, probably like a quarter mile. And I think it's... In fact, when I drive from my house to his house, that's the way I go because it's the shortest route.
And, do you think about it every time?
No, not always. But it's, I think it's two things. One, it's sort of his organic vision of Mulholland Drive. You know, it's sort of, it's all about the headlights illuminating things because there's very little streetlight, right. You know, if any. You know, there's a few, but not many. So it's sort of exposing things and then letting them go dark again. And the other is, I think that I always felt like Mulholland Drive was his Sunset Boulevard. You know, it was his sort of...
it's a fascinating comparison.
You know, the disappointment of Hollywood, you know, the vision of it and the reality of it are so different and how tragic it can be. And, you know, both named after two of the longest streets in the city.
Did he ever bring up that comparison?
No, but he loves that movie. When he built his screening room, that was the first film he screened. So he loves the, you know, he just sort of has a reverence for old Hollywood. That yeah. is,
I would guess that his furniture then maybe has some Hollywood Regency style.
No, it's all that stuff you saw in Lost
Highway.
Yeah, he lives in a Lloyd Wright house. Yeah. It's all very 60s modern.
Right, right. Any particular reason why now he's doing the weather on one of the radio stations?
Oh, he used to do it for his website. Right. DavidLynch.com, every day he would do the weather. And then I think one of the radio stations picked it up. I don't know if he's still doing it or not.
Is there a certain element of tongue-in-cheek with that? Is there a certain element of just like, yeah, I'm going to do the weather? Yeah,
I think it's sort of that... it's sort of like that line, I always think of that line in the Randy Newman song, "Looks like another perfect day," you know. It doesn't change much.
Right.
You can almost run the same... You know, you can have a group of 10 and just run... whichever one fit that day, because that's how much the weather changes.
Right. So it's almost like, it is tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
That's funny. Another sequence in Mulholland Drive that I'd like to talk about, it's sort of more of a general question about certain styles. You know, obviously, again, how you tend to achieve, I think when I look at Mulholland Drive, I see a lot of this magical Peter Deming quality of when we're inside the apartment that Betty gets set up at her aunt's place at the beginning, when we're inside the office where the audition occurs. There's many, many other locations, sort of interior or even day exterior, the diner before we go outside and see the man behind the garbage appear.
Was it a man?
Well, it looks like a monster. And then we see him again later, you know, sitting in front of a fire.
Right.
We sort of handheld walk up to him or something.
Right, right.
You have this ability to make things contoured and engaging, but not like, you know, it doesn't feel like movie lighting. It just feels like, I don't know.
Right.
I
mean, right.
And you're sort of, you're never underexposing. I don't think. I mean, you can tell me better than I can tell you, but are you underexposing a little bit? Are you
not on something? Purpose? No. I think it's sort of. I would describe it as sort of natural light versus unnatural light. I think that, you know, in the aunt's apartment, most of those looks are sort of natural daylight. You know, maybe stylized a little bit. There's a scene with Betty and Rita on the couch where we sort of stylize Rita, but Betty sort of lit naturally. And then, you know, when you get into Diane's apartment and those sorts of things, you sort of, you know, the light is more, it's more unnatural, where it doesn't really make sense when you break it down, analyze it, where the light should be coming from. Right. You sort of, you know, just go with more of a mood-enhancing lighting style rather than, you know, what would be the case in reality. And as long as you don't go too far in that direction, you know, you can, it seems natural, but it's really not. It maybe has more of a creepy feel to it.
Right. And then on the converse side, the theater, the she's the girl, you know, you're gonna say this, you're gonna do this.
Right.
The cowboy, at the top of the hill.
Who, yeah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, the story is that he was one of the financiers.
He's one of the producers.
He's one of the, yeah, one of the producers and mm-hmm. never acted or something like that.
I think he maybe was in one other film, but he didn't, I don't think he had the amount of dialogue he had in David's movie.
And he's, that performance is, you know, it's, you know, Walter Murch says we don't see beyond the edges of the frame, right? For the editor,
right,
for us.
Right.
It's just spooky.
Yeah.
The spooky performance, right? How much work, how many takes, you know, did it take to get for David to get him where he needed? But anyway, style-wise, these things are very, very stark. You know, single source appearing, right, type, right, thing, and like hard shadows, and you know, is it just again, is it a conscious choice, or just like that's what?
Well, it's always sort of a give and take with David, is, you know, he. Of what would be out there naturally compared to what you need, you know, technically to expose film,
yeah,
you know, which he isn't always happy with. He wants it, you know, there's a famous story during Twin Peaks where it was an exterior and he came out and they said, we're ready. He came out and had him turn off every light except the flashlight. And then they shot the scene, you know, so he's very sort of ultra uber reality based. So we would, knowing that, you know, it'd be like, we'd have the discussion, you know, are there any lights anywhere that we can use, you know? And so we'll sort of bargain what they are, and then I'll sort of ask him how much he wants to see in the background, you know, when he wants it to fall off into black, you know, do we want to see that? And sort of get very specific in scenes like that about, you know, what we want to see. You know, what is the sort of light level of this environment?
Right.
And so that's sort of how the stable scene was, you know, he allowed me one light, basically, you know, above the gate, and that was pretty much it.
That was beautiful. It was a beautiful scene. When you watch the finished product, and it becomes this tremendous. One other thing, very beginning, we see couples dancing in a very crude special effect that looks like, I think it's just a green screen turned purple, right?
Probably.
Yeah. And so they're you know, the dancing and they're out of sequence, so swing dancing. You know, again, the references to Hollywood, the references to the golden days.
Right.
Later in the movie, Betty's parents. Menacing little parents walk out of the keyhole, right, or
under the door. Yeah,
and it's, the special effects are crude, in their own way, right? It's like it's any. I mean, at this point, I don't know how much is this sort of like for you. You've done a lot of special effects, a little bit, but like, how do you approach the special effects in this situation where they're meant to look?
Well, I think it was two things. One, we shot elements of the aunt and I assume her boyfriend, I don't know. Didn't really know where they were going to go. Nor did David, I don't think. But I think that ultimately when it became time to do those effects, there was probably not the financial resources David would have liked.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, because to me, I watch it and I go, it had to be intended that way.
Well, you know, certainly I would say this, if he saw it and hated it, he would either have it redone or cut it out.
Right.
So I think there was a quality to it that he really liked.
Right.
Once he saw it, and so then it's in the movie. But actually, you know, those two, I can't quite explain that part of it. You know, a lot of it I can sort of explain, but... That, you know, and then we see them in the very beginning, you know, after at the airport,
yeah,
when she gets picked up and they're driving away, and there's sort of a peculiar moment between the two of them. I couldn't really tell you what that's about. I don't know whether they're orchestrating this whole nightmare or what. I don't know.
It's funny you mention that. I just interpret it as their super ego, you know, that
it's
part of her conscience that won't let her go.
Maybe.
I won't let her get away with it, but
let's just do the card switch.
Card switch? Yeah, awesome. This is great. Anyway.
You're up.
So, So, where were we? We were talking about... it's just such a fascinating text to talk about Mulholland Drive. I mean, you know, it's just a fascinating movie. When you finally saw the finished product, what was your reaction to it? I mean, were you able to just take a step back and go, well, this is amazing? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, even though you're sort of intimately involved, it's always sort of a, you know, surprise revelation when you see what David's put together, you know. You know, I often say, you know, people say, oh, this shot was great or that shot was great. It's actually, if you saw it in daily silent, you would have just thought it was okay. But once he, you know, puts it in context and puts sound on it, the visuals take on a stronger meaning, you know, so it's sort of cheating in a way, but, you know, but he's the one who has the big picture, so.
Right. You're a film guy.
I'm a film guy until this last movie.
Okay, until this last picture, okay. But you are, you love, like most great cinematographers, you love the stock.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of your favorite stocks over the years that, you know?
I'd lose the numbers sometimes, but okay. It changed so much. But when they first came out with the, but the previous version, I think it was 05.
Okay.
It was a 250 daylight. Uh-huh. That was, still the 77 is a really great stock because it was fine grain, it was daylight balanced, you know, so you could shoot it all day, and then, you know, when you start to lose light at the end of the day, all you had to do is take the ND filters out and keep shooting with the same stock. You know, sometimes I would...
By the way, any of the fanboys that go, that's not the right stock, it's not 77, he's talking about the 250 daylight, okay? He shot Mulholland Drive.
Actually, when it first came out, it was 93, and then I think they changed it to 05, and then it was 77.
So I think 77 was the 320 tungsten. I think it was 79 was the 500.
Yes, 87 was the
87. Okay,
which was quite grainy, and I didn't really use it much.
The 250 daylight you loved.
Because you could, you know, even if you push it a stop, it didn't take much of a hit.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would use it at night.
Yeah.
You know, to get a different effect because you know, the spectrum was different on it, and so that was a great stock, and you know. The 19's a great stock.
Yeah.
Probably those two.
Ever do anything crazy with the processing?
I mean, we did a lot of... Well, actually, it was the reversal that we cross-processed From Hell.
Right, oh, right. We did a bunch of stuff those in From Hell with that. Although there was a lot of stuff in From Hell, like... I seem to remember, I mean, there's a lot of close-ups on Johnny Depp that... are just sort of memorable, and there's a scene where he and Holm are talking with a seemingly like a chandelier in the middle of the room.
Yeah,
beautiful, beautiful effect. It looked extremely net, like real to what the setting was.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was another. There's one wide shot with a time lapse.
Yeah, it was motion control.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that was just like a beautiful, beautiful shot.
Yeah, those are always interesting because you really don't know what you have until you get it back from the lab.
Right.
You know, and then they do the dissolve between the A and B sides.
So what parts of it, was it all from Hell's cross-process reversals?
No. There were...
it couldn't have been.
There were like these, I don't know what you call them, like killer vision or, you know, sort of snippets of the murders that... that we created like that, and you know, we sort of, you know, in prep did some tests. We did the cross process, and then sort of like, well, how can we achieve that without actually cross processing? And then decided that we would just do it photochemically, so it couldn't be changed. So down the road, you know, the studio couldn't say we don't like that. You know, well, sorry, it's baked in now. You can't.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That so you actually consciously made that decision.
Yeah, I mean, because you're always sort of wary of locking yourself into something technically that even the filmmakers might decide they don't like later.
Right.
But they wanted to commit to that, and I agreed with them.
Right. let's just jump ahead a bit to before Cam Woods. There was another one I wanted to talk to you about, that just a tremendous achievement in your photography. Ah! Drag me to hell. So, I'm presuming that Sam Raimi, I'm just, you know, you can tell me, but done, you know, break between Spider-Man franchises, or he's done with Spider-Man franchise, and he has this script that he really wants to make. And you worked with him on Evil Dead 2, mm-hmm. haven't worked with him since on these other pictures that he's made. He runs into you, picks up the phone, he thinks of you. How did that come about?
It came about, I'm not really sure. I mean, I got the call from my agents and said, you know, Sam Raimi's doing this, what for him was a low-budget movie, which was like 25.
Yeah.
You know, called Drag Me to Hell. You sort of, you know the genre right away. And, you know, do you want to read it? And I was like, well, sure. You know, it's been 20-some years. So they sent me the script, and before it even got to me, they called back and said, you know, Sam wants you to do the movie. I said, okay, well, let me read it and call him, but yeah, I'll do it, you know, so.
When you read it, what did you think?
I thought it was classic Sam.
Yeah.
You know, without, I think without the sort of gore aspect, you know, of his earlier career, it's more of a psychological horror.
Yeah. Well, this is a movie that I think nobody didn't like. You know, everybody liked this movie. The audience liked this movie. The critics liked this movie.
Yeah, you know, actually.
Once in a while, like, in the same way True Grit, the Coen Brothers' recent effort, reminded us that Westerns could be really, really dazzling existential mm-hmm. pieces. This movie reminded us that an old-fashioned monster story could be absolutely riveting, and it was from frame one all the way on. You know, and again, we see some very interesting photography from you where it just seems to get more and more and more. I mean, there's a very subtle element of sort of a wistfulness to the initial scene that takes place much earlier.
Right.
You know, like the
right.
I guess Pasadena, I guess it's set in, or no, I mean, maybe you'd be wrong, but it's the house where
right.
at the beginning of the movie we first see the monster.
Right.
And then we flash forward to it's Alison Lohman, right? Playing the young banker with Justin Long as her boyfriend, and everything's gonna be great. And then this gypsy woman comes into
the
her
bank,
life
yeah.
at the bank. You know, and of course nobody in the bank thinks it's weird this woman with, you know.
Right.
But, you know, so the things that jump out to me are, in the beginning, you did something to the look of it to make it feel a little bit old.
Yeah.
And then we have a little bit more contrasty look from you going into the modern day story than maybe we, you know, you normally do.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets really, really super interesting when we go back to the house and there's the seance and these other scenes.
Right.
Just, do you want to tell us what you were going for?
Well, I mean, it's sort of, we talked about it, you know, I just from reading the script, I told Sam it sort of reminded me of, like, a Hitchcock movie, where you do have this element of a monster and the supernatural, but it's mostly based, you know, rooted in reality, or the perception of reality from this girl. And wouldn't it be fun to sort of make, and, you know, Sam... One thing I remember about Sam, you know, even when he's making a monster movie or a dark movie, he doesn't like really dark the way, say, David would like really dark. He still is sort of a classic, you know, I want to see everything sort of taste, you know. So I thought that sort of look, that, you know, 50s look would sort of play into what he likes and
right.
might give it. And I think the most conscious effort of that was the dinner scene at the parents' house.
Right.
You know, it's sort of, you know, classic studio lighting, even though it was a location, you know, and sort of not overly dark, overly moody. You know, I think Kubrick proved a long time ago that bright could be just as scary, you know, in The Shining. It's like nothing was particularly dark in that film, but it was really, really creepy.
Yeah.
And so there was sort of an element of that. You know, we knew that when we got to the seance, it was going to become a little theatrical and sort of just, I think we just sort of played with people's expectations and sort of amped it up a little bit in whatever way that was, you know. You know, we did, and all the stuff that Sam loves to do, like under crank, you know, we still did that stuff. And so
we're talking about the most wonderful, I mean, talk about Sam Raimi tropes, you know, old women with seemingly super Herculean strength,
yeah,
right, in Army of Darkness, you know. You're so old.
Or, you know, the guy flying around with a deformed...
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But in this situation, the gypsy woman comes and attacks her in the parking lot.
Yeah.
In the car.
Yeah.
And I think everyone watching the scene thinks that it's just going to be a little scare. Like, we're going to see, like, a glimpse, and then she's going to drive off. But
right.
No, the scene just gets worse and worse and worse worse. And you're just like, this is a fucking fist fight. Like,
yeah.
They're just going at each other, right?
Yeah.
So, how long did it take to shoot a sequence like that?
That scene was, I think we spent, in the location, we were there at least 5 or 6 nights.
Wow.
And then, it was one of those, you know, in film production, it's what you call the phone booth, where there's always a scene in a movie where it's on the schedule, and then time permitting, at the end of the day, we'll get that phone call that we owe, you know. So there was always elements, as he cut it together, that he wanted to shoot. So we had the cars, you know, one of them came apart, and we just shot stuff in front of green screen pretty much the whole shoot. You know, oh, we need a close-up for the garage. We need a, you know, a shot of Ganoush. We need a shot of a jaw hitting the thing, you know, whatever that he decided he needed, we would just do. And so it was the never-ending scene. You know, bits and pieces were added.
Well, it turned into be one of the most riveting things.
It's pretty epic. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's an epic fight.
There was one point, I know, with Sam and I, where I think when... She and her boyfriend go to sleep, and she has a dream. You know, she rolls over, and it's really Mrs. Ganoush, and starts attacking her, and sort of vomits up all these maggots. And we were doing the shot where...
There's something funny about maggots. Yeah,
well, when you hear the story, it's sort of Allison's POV of Mrs. Ganoush vomiting maggots on her.
Right.
And so we set it all up, you know, and it's like a prosthetic head, and they got this big plunger with this, with the pasta, you know, that looked like maggots. And I said, okay, Sam, come on over, you know, I said, okay, he says, so they're shaking the head, and the maggots come out, and he just looked at me, and we just looked at each other and started cracking up. We're like, here we are, like 22 years later, still doing this maggots throwing up on the camera.
How much of it is that Sam likes to get stuff in camera?
Very much.
Are you a big fan of that?
Yeah, whenever possible.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that things happen with mechanics and photochemical that you don't expect.
Right.
You know, happy accidents happen that, you know, something might happen that's even cooler than what you could imagine it would be, you know.
Right. Yeah. Things moving the wrong way or falling the wrong way or whatever.
Yeah, who knows?
In the sequence where Allison, the monster's starting to stalk now, she's been given the coin.
Right.
The coin is the curse. I just love talking about the movie because it's just so fun to talk about. She's been given the coin, she's been given the curse, and all of a sudden she's being stalked, and there's a sequence where she's alone in the house.
Wait, no, it's a button.
No, oh, sorry, the coin was the wrong thing, right? By the way,
that's the end
of the movie. When she's given the button.
Right.
When I'm watching the movie with my wife, the minute you saw Justin Long put that in, I was so overjoyed because I knew that it was going, I mean, I pay more attention than maybe your average person, or
maybe
I don't, but, you know, I've been fooled plenty of times. Sixth Sense, I had no idea whatever was going to happen. But,
right.
In this case, I was just, oh, you know, and then it came out, anyway. So she's been given the beginning of the movie, she's been given the button. Mm-hmm. She's been given the curse. She has it, you know, she owns it. The monster's starting to stalk her. And she's alone in the house, and things start to... There's a sequence where the shadow of the monster starts trailing her all over the room. This is absolutely horrifying when you're watching this. You're just... Because it's like... I think what's different about the sequence is that the monster's there, but not powerful enough yet to actually physically attack her. So she can't slam a door and hold that door shut and rail against the door and go, I'm going to keep you out. This is more about, I can't get away from you, and I can't get away from you, you're not going to leave me alone, but this thing isn't powerful yet enough to reach out and bludgeon her to death or whatever. How did you go about shooting that sequence?
I remember there was one where she's in the living room.
Yeah.
And a car passes by, and you have this moving shadow that turns into the...
Yes.
That's something we talked about in prep, and we actually set it up on a stage, the sort of the physicality of the location where we'd shoot, you know, the size of the window of the house, how far away the road was, you know. Ultimately, it wasn't a car, obviously, it was a cinema light doing the effect, but I wanted to get the right feel of a car headlight passing and traveling that light so that we could create a shadow on the wall that the visual effects could then add on to. You know, they said they couldn't start from scratch. They needed something organic to work with. So we had some plants. We played with some plants, some ferns or whatever, that as the light traveled, it traveled around the wall. It got the keystoning and all that. That was natural to the room, so that they could mimic that and turn it into, you know, the Lamia.
And then later when things are shaking on the walls and things are, is that all done practically?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah. How does it take people or just
people
shaking things?
People shaking things. Lots of people.
When you're shooting that, does it feel any of it feel goofy, or do you actually get the horror?
It always feels goofy, but, you know, that's where Sam, you know, sort of has the eye of that line between goofy and what can be scary ultimately in the movie. I mean, we did a lot of that on Evil Dead 2. There was a whole laughing room where the camera went from completely Dutched to straight and went in on Bruce, and the whole room was laughing. Books and cushions, and, you know, there were probably 20, 25 people manipulating items under the floor or behind couches or whatever. And, you know, it's a pretty interesting effect once you build the sound under it and everything.
Are you conscious of the cutting when you're shooting things, just so that, like, you know, you could be another eye for...
Yeah, always. I mean, as you see things you shot get cut, you know, and sometimes you're able to talk to the editor and say, why didn't you use this, why didn't you use that? And they're, you know, it's always story-driven or pace-driven, you know, so... You have to be conscious of that when you're shooting the movie, you know, and you're doing something that will ultimately be cut up into 10 pieces, you know.
Yeah.
Whether it's worth taking the time to make it one shot or whatever, you know, or it's a transition from one to the other that you're concerned with.
Let's talk a little bit about Cabin in the Woods. One of the most original concepts, brilliantly executed in the last however long.
Mm-hmm.
It will stand the test of time, I think, as being, you know, because it just took, you know, it's one thing to take a genre and turn it on its head. You know, Freddy versus Jason in many ways took a genre and turned it on its head because it created this triangle of conflict instead of just like that.
Right.
But this movie, you know, tips its hat to a whole genre while never making anyone feel as though you're watching a movie about filmmaking, and yet you're watching a movie about people pulling strings and people manipulating and stuff like that. You know, it's always explaining horror movie tropes.
Right.
Where they cut, you know. Was it actually Joss Whedon, or was it the director who wanted to bring you onto that project?
I think it was mostly Drew, you know. Yeah. Obviously, Joss was a producer, so he was all for it. but I think, you know.
Let me just give it, was it, let me just re-say, was it Joss Whedon or was it Drew who wanted you to do that? I'm just saying that again because.
Oh, okay.
I said Joss or the director.
You know, okay. you know, I think it's probably mostly Drew.
Yeah.
You know, Joss was certainly agreeable to that and,
yeah.
you know, was around when I went to meet on it. And it sort of was interesting to me to sort of go from, you know, sort of an archetype
yeah.
horror film that I was involved with long ago and then sort of take off from that and, you know, try to explain it all.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you immediately just want to do it?
I did. You know, I was really interested in it. I wasn't sure. I guess my main concern was with the sort of second act and the sort of, you know, the sort of goriness of that and whether that was necessary or not.
You mean, oh, do you mean the very end of the movie when they're in the...
No, no, that's all. I'm with all that. You know,
okay.
Sort of the middle where, you know, they start killing the
actual kids.
Yeah. And sort of how much of that you had to show to sort of make it work. And that's where, you know, Drew and Joss particularly, you know, sort of really understand the genre and the audience for that genre, you know. And I remember a couple of times Drew, we talk about it, and once he said to me, you know, I have to show this. This is what, you know, this is part of the process. It's what makes these people underground so gruesome, really, is that they allow this to happen. And then we were doing a shot, I remember, in the cabin, and I asked him, you know, why are we doing this shot? You know, it doesn't particularly advance the story or anything. And he just looked at me, and this is him understanding his audience. He said, because it's cool. Because this is a cool shot. And the audience for this movie will get that.
Right.
And so,
which shot is it, by the way?
I think it was behind Anna as she was going for the wolf head.
Oh yeah, yeah, no,
yeah.
She jumps
in the frame.
It starts French kissing the wolf head on the edit.
Well, that was after. That wasn't part of the shot. I'm talking about.
I see. Okay, she totally goes for it.
Right. But you know, it's just sort of they're so connected to the genre and the audience,
right?
That. They pushed all the right buttons. And while I was along for most of those buttons, there were some buttons that only they could understand. And, you know, that's when you just sort of...
Do it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you always have to have, you know, you sort of have to trust your directors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're coming at it from a different place than you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're not always, you know, on the same page. And they've certainly been with it much longer and will be with it much longer than you will.
Right.
So it's, and you know, rarely are you sort of disappointed by those moments. You know, when you see the film, you're like, you understand why they were going for that.
Was there any cognizant effort put in to make the... Spoiler! The underground lair...
I want to watch it so badly. I'm trying not to listen. I've been, did you know, Scott's plugging my ears? I don't want to hear this.
Right.
I have to go in the other room.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. Well, actually, it won't even matter because
I'm watching it.
It's spoiled from the very beginning. It's just such a compelling. I mean, what I was asking when I'm watching it are who are the actual protagonists? Are the protagonists.
Right.
The underground dwellers, from a structural perspective,
right,
because it is so well structured, this movie, and the third act of the movie is such a great lesson in, no, you really want to change the game in the third act,
right?
You know, you have to go changing the game for your audience. I think at the end of the day, the main character happens to be the girl from the beginning, you know, the girl in
Stone. Right.
But it, you know, we're questioning whether or not it isn't those two guys. When we go down to the underground lair, when they get there, the characters get there, was there a conscious effort as to how you were going to deal with, you know, with a different look or a different tone or?
Yeah, I mean, it had to be completely different than the rest of the movie, and it certainly was much more sort of clinical and industrial and You know, and that was fine because it had to be, you know, it's enough of a shock thematically, you know, and reality-wise to these people that, you know, the environment had to be, you know, the opposite of what they would imagine, you know.
Complete side note. Have you ever had actors tell you how to light? Have you ever been in the situation where you have actors telling them how to be lit?
All the time. Usually actresses more than actors.
Right. What do you do?
Well, you listen for one, because they've been looking at that face longer than you have, and they probably have some good things to say.
Uh-huh.
They don't always apply to the situation you're in.
Right.
And, you know, sort of do what you can to make them feel comfortable. Because you don't want, you know, you don't want any antagonism during a shoot, because it's not good.
You ever been fired off a job?
No.
You ever quit? Yeah, not gonna. You ever quit?
Not as a DP. No.
Okay. Well, this is. How much of this would you attribute to your stoicism?
I don't know.
Which, by the way, is just a guess.
I think it's just, you know, no matter how long you do this job, there's always something to learn, you know, whether it's technical or from a filmmaking perspective or just from a life perspective from people, that you just sort of strive to get through, you know, the end of the process. Fortunately, I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I dreaded, you know, work every day. I've been pretty fortunate to work with, you know, talented people who happen to be nice, you know, who happen to enjoy the craft, and any sort of, you know, I won't say tension, but any sort of contention is creative based and can be worked out.
Mm-hmm. It's very, just a quick word, the Oz, the Great and Powerful, mm-hmm. coming out soon. So this, I'm just saying from a guess, is by far the biggest, craziest project that you've been involved with. At least it seems like
that. Yeah, I would say yes.
Okay. Format?
3D.
Oh.
Digital 3D.
Okay. Scared about that? Nervous about that?
I was for a couple of weeks until I sort of jumped into it and started learning about it. And, you know, once you sort of learn the theory and then get a couple days hands-on, it's all common sense.
Right.
It really is common sense.
Were you using 3Reality Technica for this?
We were using Element Technica. They were still separate at the time.
Okay.
They hadn't merged yet.
These are the people that pioneered for Darius Wolski on...
Prometheus. We used the exact same rig with the exact same cameras.
So Epics in stereo.
Yes, with the Atom rig, although we use different... We use Panavision lenses, not...
You mounted those panties, okay. Yeah. And my I've spoken to a few people in this world now, just for curiosity's sake. You know, not because I'm planning on shooting anything in 3D. We should mm-hmm. do a shot in 3D. my understanding is that, like, it's not just about, oh, you know, like, adding the second camera, it's bulkier, and it's a lot more light because now you're going through the mirror and you lose half a stop or one stop. Yeah. That would make sense, 50% of the light. But it's also that because of the eye's perception of things, that one can't, like, if you use a certain lensing in a certain situation, people will appear huge or the perspective will all go out of whack. And, you know, you can't just drag people's eyes wherever you want. You have to be cognizant of motion and flow and,
right.
like, all these things, right?
Right.
So how much learning was there for you in all this world? Like, is that all part of it?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of things you're talking about, the miniaturization or the enlarging of, is all sort of based upon focal lengths and what the interocular setting is, the distance between the two lens centers, which is something that when you're shooting can't be changed later. Now, the convergent, which is where the screen plane lives and what comes out at you and what lives behind it, for the most part can be changed later and needs to be, because when the film is cut together, sometimes certain shots, the convergence on certain shots is uncomfortable. So you have to slide those to a more pleasing place. It's also a bigger picture of how to use focal lengths in a movie. You know, it's sort of 3D, you know, if you're on set and you line up a shot and you say, okay, so this is a 50 millimeter, you know, people sort of look at you like, are you crazy? You know, like, we rarely went above that. That was our long lens, you know. Then you maybe get to a 65 or 75, it's a close-up of something. But generally speaking, you want field of view, you want depth of field, all those things that in 2D you sort of hate sometimes because it seems flat. But because the dimension is built in, the more depth cues you can have in a shot, you know, distances of items to tell you that there's depth, the more powerful the shots are in 3D, the more successful they are in 3D. So it's a whole different mindset of building sets, decorating sets, choosing lenses, and, you know, fortunately you have digital now, so you can do lineup, you can do color, you know, you're starting at 640, 800 ASA, so you're really only going down to 320, which is manageable, but you want to shoot at a 4, or at least, you know,
to get
as much depth of field as possible, even though you're on a 27 or a 24.
So you're pounding it with light.
Yeah, even for night work, you know. But you have the advantage of, you know, the DIT station to sort of bring you back to reality, to sort of darken it and make sure it's working, you know, as a look.
Right. You have to sort of shoot in your head a little bit because obviously you're
yes.
trying to get that depth of field.
Yeah.
How did you like working with the Red camera? I mean, it's something that just, you know, a lot of people who will watch this, you know, they focus more on the technical side.
Right,
of it.
Right.
Part of what we're doing here is trying to make sure people know that the artistic side is the critical part is the thinking. But,
yeah.
But, you know, just for curiosity's sake, how did you like working with the Epic?
I thought it was great. You know, yeah. We... it's very small, obviously, for a 3D application. That was a huge advantage.
Yeah.
The onboard capture is a huge advantage.
Yeah.
It, you know, things change so fast in digital world. At the time we shot, which was 2011, basically the last 6 months, it was the highest resolution camera for what we were doing. I mean, we couldn't release the film in the resolution it was captured in. It would be too expensive.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of data to work with for visual effects. Sam loved to shoot, you know, if it was film, he would love to shoot a lot of Vista Vision so he could blow frames up and recompose. You can do all that with the Epic.
Yeah.
We could, you know, visual effects said you can blow up 50% with no loss in resolution.
Right.
So, you know,
it's interesting because you actually can. I mean,
I
sat in a room and the post house at the time tried to convince me, oh, we'll just do the blow up in 2K, you don't need to go back to the original 4K. And
right.
Then we went back to the original 4K, it just looks so much better, right? But the point is, you can take that original 4K or 5K, I'm presuming you shot 5K,
right,
and blow up significantly. And but if you do that on film, the grain really starts to show.
Yeah.
And that's not, I don't know, it's weird because we know there's more resolution in film at the end of the day, but it just shows the granulars more, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's based on bits of silver film, so you can't really get away from that unless
right.
you make them smaller, which makes them slower.
Right.
So, but, you know, all those things were a huge advantage in the 3D world.
Did you like shooting 3D?
I did. I mean, you know, for my first time out in digital
yep.
and 3D, I was sort of it's a dream film. I mean, it's like I'll never have that luxury again, I don't think. We shot the entire film on stages.
Wow.
There's not one frame that shot outside.
Wow.
That includes all the day exterior work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, huge sets, huge lighting setups, and just total control of everything. And you know, that just doesn't happen anymore. And it was a very conscious decision by Sam before I was involved, and I agreed with them completely to shoot it in the same fashion as the Wizard of Oz from 39, which was all on sound stages. And it was funny because as we started doing research, you know, a couple of books written about the production of that movie at MGM in Culver City said that, you know, the stages, they used so much light because that was Technicolor.
Yeah.
And the stages got so hot they had to, you know, stop shooting and open the doors and let it air out. You know, fortunately we had pretty good air conditioning.
Right.
But, you know, we're using an incredible amount of light to create the exterior. I mean, you have an enormous amount of light just to create ambient, and then you have to create a sun, which was a massive thing that we built that can
what
cover.
Was in that, just out of curiosity?
It was PAR lamps. This is 178 PAR lamps. So that's 178,000 watts. And it was.
That's a lot of light.
The stages were. That we're doing this work, you know, were like 250 feet long. So it had to cover 200 feet, you know, which is a lot for a light.
Just out of curiosity, 178 1K PARs, right? While that will generate that much light, with the fact that it's multi-point source going through, I would presume some one piece.
Mm-hmm.
Can it still throw?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
I mean, 100 feet away, you turn it on, you feel the heat from it. There's no question.
It would cook you.
Oh, yeah. You know, we had, there's one set, there was a lot of greenery, and we had it, it was the scene took place early in the morning, so we had it quite low coming, you know, raking across the floor, and one of the evergreen trees basically turned brown. You got burned by this light.
He killed the tree.
No trees were hurt.
No, we killed the tree, yeah, we did.
What was the, is there any sequences in the movie? I haven't seen it yet. You know, but
I haven't really seen it either. There's so much visual effects to do, but there's some really great sequences. You know, it's some are effects based, some are, you know, more in camera. But you know, it's you know, we didn't go on location. Obviously, which I said we didn't have a location department. You know, we never got on a van and scouted.
Right.
You know? And it was sort of like, you know, where do you go to scout Oz? You know, it's sort of, you can sort of find, you know, Middle Earth for those movies.
Right.
So it was, you know, I really enjoyed the beginning of the film, which will be in black and white, much like the original.
Fabulous.
And it was really great to do black and white 3D. It was really stark and really striking to me.
Fabulous.
I like to do a whole film like that.
I'm noticing that from a lot of DPs, by the way. They're all saying I'd really like to shoot a movie in black and white. Mm. And I think it has nothing to do with the nostalgia of, I mean, well, maybe a little bit to do with the nostalgia, but it seems that it has a lot to do with just, you know, such artists wanting to just be able to focus on something so pure.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of breaks it down really to composition, contrast, and, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is a new Epic monochrome, a red Epic monochrome.
What does that do?
They took the Bayer buffer, the color filter, off, and it only shoots black and white, so the ISO jumps up by a stop and a half or something like that.
Interesting.
And it's sharper because there's less with the way of the filter.
Right.
And so something tells me that there's going to be an Alexa monochrome. And probably if, you know, Peter Deming twists the arm of Panavision, you know, there might even be a, you know.
Well, they got their own thing coming out soon.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to be a category killer?
Yeah, it's going to blow the doors off.
Everything.
Well, it's, I'll just say that it's going to capture, data capture and exhibition will have to catch up.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They got a lot of data going on.
Cryptic. I'll leave it cryptic. Anything you're looking forward to doing next that you, or anything you'd like to do?
There's lots of stuff. I mean, I'd mostly like David to do another movie, you know, whether I'm involved in it or not. But, no, I'm looking, you know, I don't know. I sort of enjoy it all, so I just do want to do something that I'm behind.
Well, thank you very much for giving us all these images over the years, for being involved in such a great personality to give to life to all these images.
My pleasure.
All these images. Peter Deming.
All right.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
Okay. Now I'll introduce you. What I learned is I do the interview without introducing the person. The minute I introduce the person, they go like that. You know? So okay. Welcome back to Craft Truck Through the Lens here in the offices of Handheld Films, and we're very lucky today to have with us a cinematographer who over the years has worked not only in a wide variety of genres and worked with a wide variety of filmmakers, but has created some of the most dazzling images that have ever been put to celluloid, but also been involved in some of the most incredible and unique films and has given them life, Mr. Peter Deming. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
There we go.
All right.
That's it. Thanks.
So wait, do you still want to do your...
Oh, yeah. Sorry, can you do just 5 more minutes?
Sure.
What I'll do, thank you for reminding me. We'll do a little bit of audible Rorschach. I'll name the photographer, and you just give me a few thoughts. And don't worry, you know, if you don't want to cut it, we can... You don't want to comment, right. No problem.
My Alzheimer's might kick in, so...
Early onset.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, some thoughts. Mr. Unfortunately recently deceased Harris Savides.
Well, on that note, I mean, incredibly tragic. But I think someone who really took a lot of chances and just saw things the way he wanted and was willing to see that through to the end, which is extremely admirable, you know, and sort of didn't care about the marketplace and was just really a pure artist.
Some films of his that were your favorites?
Elephant, American Gangster. I thought he really went dark in a different way. That was really interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, I just was always looking forward to his stuff coming out.
Yeah. Totally agree. By the way, what I was told yesterday by Tom Richman, I don't know if it's true, he said American Gangster did not have a DI.
And it could be.
And I'm looking at thinking about the movie, going, is that possible? Like, it was just because he did this weird contrasty thing. Mm-hmm, anyway, mm-hmm. It was very weird. Anyway, Mr. Roger Deakins.
Well, I mean, he's sort of larger than life in a way, but you know, but at the same time, extremely accessible and sort of humble, which. You know, with that body work, I find amazing. A true innovator, and also someone, you know, this always comes up. I mean, was told to me by mentors to take chances and just sort of go out on a limb, because if you play it safe all the time, you're never going to get anywhere, and I think Roger does that all the time. Just keeps going.
Any particular films of his that are your favorite work of his?
You know, whole films, you know, sort of all of them. I think No Country is great. You know, you go back to 1984, which is, mm-hmm. you know, maybe by today's standards isn't that out there, but the time was pretty shocking to see.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, just so many, like every, you know, Fargo for its, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, having Bright still be scary, you know, sort of just creating a world, and it's very exciting to see Roger and James Bond together.
Yeah.
You know, that's one I want to do someday, and I'm glad they finally got, you know, someone like him to do one.
Got it. Mr. Gordon Willis.
I think Gordon is sort of, he's like a classical painter to me. There's a simplicity and a purity to what he shoots that I don't think people understand how hard it is, you know, and how, you know, because he makes it look so easy, you know. You know, it's like you can say, oh, well, a lot of the stuff he did with Woody is that way. But, you know, then you look at Godfather, which was really dark and took a lot of chances. You know, his famous story about the studio wanted to fire him because they couldn't see Brando's eyes, you know, that kind of stuff. And just, you know, if you've ever met Gordy or know him, it just comes out in his personality, you know. He sees it one way, and that's how he's going.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we got. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks, man. That was awesome. Sorry to keep you so long.
No problem.
You were great.